Hello and welcome to NewsHour live from the BBC World Service in London. I'm Rebecca Kesby. Relations between Kyiv and Washington DC, which are already strained, were dealt another blow today when US President Donald Trump took to social media to lambast the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in the harshest terms yet. In a long post on his own social media platform, Truth Social, Mr. Trump accused Mr. Zelensky of being a dictator without elections, who'd done a terrible job for Ukraine and who just wanted to keep the gravy train of USA going. Well, one of my colleagues has voiced up more of the frankly jaw-dropping post. Have a listen to this.
Think of it. A modestly successful comedian, Volodymyr Zelensky, talked the United States of America into spending $350 billion to go into a war that couldn't be won, that never had to start, but a war that he, without the US and Trump, will never be able to settle. The United States has spent $200 billion more than Europe, and Europe's money is guaranteed, while the United States will get nothing back. Why didn't sleepy Joe Biden demand equalization in that this war is far more important to Europe than it is to us? We have a big, beautiful ocean as separation. On top of this, Zelensky admits that half of the money we sent him is missing. He refuses to have elections, is very low in Ukrainian polls, and the only thing he was good at was playing Biden like a fiddle. A dictator without elections, Zelensky better move fast or he is not going to have a country left.
Well, Mr. Trump's post on social media came after comments he made at a press conference yesterday that were also disparaging of Mr. Zelensky, in which he said the Ukrainian president was unpopular at home, with an approval rating he claimed was just at 4%, and in which he even seemed to suggest that Ukraine had started the war. Well, in response to last night's comments and before this latest post on social media, President Zelensky dismissed the criticism and told reporters that Mr. Trump was pushing the Kremlin's agenda and lies.
We are seeing a lot of disinformation, and it's coming from Russia. We understand this, and we have proof that these figures are being discussed between America and Russia. Unfortunately, President Trump, with all due respect for him as a leader of a nation that we respect greatly, the American people are living in this disinformation space.
Well, Mr. Zelensky also pushed back on President Trump's claims regarding the cost of the war and how much the US was contributing. President Trump's words have been greeted with great enthusiasm by the Kremlin. Speaking on a trip to a drone factory in St. Petersburg today, Russian President Vladimir Putin gave this response when asked for his assessment of the peace talks between his country and the US.
Мне доложили первое, второе. Я оцениваю их.
I rate them highly. There are results. We have agreed to resume the normal work of diplomatic agencies. The constant expulsion of diplomats from Washington and Moscow does not lead to anything good. We have taken the first step in order to resume work in various areas of mutual interest. The assessment is positive. There were completely different people on the American side who were open to the negotiation process. Without any bias, without any condemnation of what had been done in the past, we are open to working together.
Russian President Putin speaking earlier today. So what do we know of Ukrainian public opinion at the moment and public support for President Zelensky? I've been speaking to Anton Grushetsky. He's executive director of the Kyiv International Institute of Sociology that's been keeping tabs on Ukrainian public opinion throughout the conflict. First, I asked him to remind us of when Volodymyr Zelensky won the last election and with what percentage margin.
Volodymyr Zelensky won elections in 2019, and in the first round he received around 30%, and in the second round he received over 70% of people's vote. And actually that year, around from 80 to 90% trust in him, it was like record trust levels in Ukraine.
Okay, so Mr. Trump has said that President Zelensky's approval ratings now are very low. He quotes a figure of 4%. Is that true?
No, it's not true. According to the most recent survey, 57% of Ukrainians trust Zelensky, do not trust 37%, so he has like plus 20% balance of trust and distrust. According to our survey conducted earlier this year, more than 60% approve his job as a president.
So how do you collect this information? It must be quite difficult considering your country's at war. How can you be sure that it's accurate?
We are conducting surveys for more than 30 years. We are highly qualified and we are conducting lots of surveys, a lot of methodological experiments. And we know that we receive really representative data for the Ukrainian people. And 4% for Mr. Trump, it looks like more like Russian sources that are surely biased.
Ukraine is obviously under emergency powers at the moment. There's a state of martial law that is extended in 90-day intervals. I think it's next up for review later this year in May. But it's the reason why there haven't been any elections at the moment. Is it possible to quantify whether there is a demand within Ukraine for fresh elections? Are people asking for that?
People are actually demanding no elections right now. According to our surveys, with different question wordings from like 65 to 75% of Ukrainians are against elections until war ends. The priority number one for this moment is to achieve some success in war and only then to discuss elections. Ukrainians are truly like committed to the democracy. 95% of Ukrainians want Ukraine to be a democracy with free and fair elections, but Ukrainians understand that only after the war it is possible. So for this moment, there are no demands among Ukrainians to conduct elections right now.
Okay. I mentioned that you work for the Kyiv International Institute of Sociology. Can I ask, where does your funding come from? Does your organization have any political affiliations? And why should people trust your figures?
We are independent research institutions. We were founded by Ukrainian prominent sociologists who also founded the Department of Sociology in one of the leading universities more than 30 years ago. And each year we conduct more than 100 surveys, mainly financed by our international partners. It could be universities, it could be like United Nations institutions or some other governmental institutions. So we are not affiliated with any party in Ukraine or like any forces in the world. We are like totally independent in this case.
Has it been possible to gauge public opinion on Mr. Trump's plans to end the war? What's the percentage of people who would back Mr. Trump's plans?
Actually, in December, the majority of Ukrainians expected there would be like partly fair, partly unfair peace for Ukraine under Trump as a president. But actually, still more than half of Ukrainians were like quite positive about his presidency. Right now, we are conducting right now another survey, and what we see in our preliminary result that much more people are disappointed with what Mr. Trump is saying and doing. So lots of people are really worrying about his statements and actions.
And that was Anton Grushetsky, there, executive director of the Kyiv International Institute of Sociology. Well, let's get a view from the United States on all of this. And I should just say that we have been calling U.S. Republican senators and members of Congress for the past few days. None have wanted to give us an interview, but we have been speaking today to Stephen Moore. He's former economic advisor for President Trump and co-founder of the conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation, and I asked him if he agreed with Mr. Trump's latest comments that Mr. Zelensky is a dictator.
Well, one thing about Donald Trump that I think everyone is starting to learn is that Trump is crazy like a fox, and I think he's sending a message to Zelensky that he wants this peace deal, he wants to stop the killing and fighting. Obviously, we as Americans understand fully that Russia is the villain here, and the Ukrainians are the freedom fighters. But it's important to Trump that, and I think to the American people, that the killing stop and that the war come to an end and that there could be, you know, a peaceful settlement here. That's Trump's goal. And I think he's engaging in some brinksmanship here to try to bring Zelensky to the bargaining table.
There's high stakes, though, aren't there? And I mean, if you look at the Russian press this week, they're absolutely delighted with Mr. Trump's perceived concessions for President Putin, which has led a lot of European commentators to talk about the Americans and Mr. Trump being full of appeasement for Russia. I mean, isn't there a real danger that the United States could be totally isolated from former European allies here?
Well, I think I trust Trump's judgment here. I think most Americans do. Remember, Donald Trump is riding a crest of popularity right now. He's got the wind at his back. And I think people are tired of the fighting. And there's certainly a reasonable peace agreement that could be made. And so we'll see how this turns out. But I do think at the end of the day, there will be a peace agreement. It's something that everybody can live with. But obviously, America has invested tens and tens of billions of dollars in the war. And so just from a financial standpoint, too, it makes sense to try to bring this to an end. And we will see how it works. But again, Trump is a master negotiator. His book, of course, is The Art of the Deal. He knows what he's doing. And I think Europeans should relax. I don't think we're going to see an appeasement like you're talking about.
Okay. I mean, it's entirely transactional, though, isn't it? The art of the deal, the way he's speaking about Ukraine, you know, from real estate points of view, and not the kind of diplomatic language which we would expect. I mean, are you surprised that you're hearing this? How do you feel about hearing this sort of language from a Republican president? Can you imagine anything like this ever coming from Ronald Reagan, for example?
Well, that's a great point. And of course, Ronald Reagan is the one who won the Cold War. And so he did that with, you know, building America's economy and rebuilding our military might. We're going to be doing that in the United States for sure. We're going to continue to make sure that our military is the most capable and best funded in the world. But Trump also doesn't like war. And he wants to be the president, not just known as the president who rebuilt the American economy, but the American president who brought an end to the fighting around the world, which would be an amazing accomplishment if he can pull it off. I would simply say that, you know, Trump does have a plan.
I'm so sorry to interrupt, but he hasn't he hasn't given Mr. Putin the same criticism that he has Mr. Zelensky. And I mean, let's just take the topic of democracy, for example. I mean, is Russia a democracy? Really?
Certainly not. And, you know, look, Putin is a villain. He's a killer. He's a criminal. And so I can't really explain the relationship between Putin and Trump. I will say this, just as the big global picture, Trump views appropriately the villain in the world today, other than Russia, of course, is China. And China is a much bigger threat to the United States in so many ways than Russia is. And so I think he's playing a little bit of a geopolitical gamesmanship here. Ultimately, you know, we'd like to see Russia and the United States against China. And maybe that's part of the plan. I'm just speculating.
Stephen Moore there, former economic advisor to President Trump and co-founder of the conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation. We'll be hearing from the Ukrainian opposition later in the programme. Do they want an election? And just as we came on air, reports coming from Odessa in southern Ukraine of a second night of bombardment. These sounds being shared on social media as people there in Odessa coming under attack again tonight. Still to come in this programme, why are supporters of the imprisoned South Korean president holding regular demonstrations against the leader of the opposition?
This moment is the conflict between the people who pursue communists and the people who pursue democracy.
If the next president would be the leader of Democratic Party, what he's talking about is to become one with Kim Jong-un.
More from South Korea to come. Our headlines this hour: Donald Trump has stepped up his verbal attacks on Volodymyr Zelensky, branding him a dictator who could lose his country after the Ukrainian leader said the US president had been taken in by Russian disinformation. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. Now, today Microsoft unveiled the world's first topological computer, or topoconductor, which is a new kind of technology which could bring us quantum computers within years much faster than previously thought. Here's the announcement from Microsoft.
This is not a work of science. It's a work of science and art.
I gotta be honest, some of these ideas are a little science fiction sounding.
It will solve problems unsolvable by the combined power of all the world's compute today, and promises to revolutionize fields such as medicine, material science, and our understanding of the natural world. Our first quantum processor based on this architecture is the Majorana 1.
Sounds exciting, doesn't it? But what exactly does it all mean? Well, Amit Katwala is features editor from Wired magazine and also the author of Quantum Computing, How It Works and Why It Could Change the World. And I asked him, what is this new technology?
A quantum computer is essentially, it's not just a faster version of our current computers. It's a fundamentally different device that basically takes advantage of some weird properties of quantum physics to do things that current computers can't do. So instead of using bits, which are ones and zeros, like a normal computer, a quantum computer uses what are called qubits. So these can be one, zero, or somewhere in between, a state called superposition. Now, that's quite complicated. I like to think of it in terms of flipping a coin. So if a normal computer could be heads or tails, a quantum computer can be heads, tails, or also a spinning coin where you don't know quite where it's going to land.
All right. Well, that sounds exciting. What can we actually do with it, though? Why would it be a good thing?
Yeah, so it's because it's kind of got this kind of probabilistic quantum aspect to it. It means it's going to be much better at simulating the natural world, which also follows those rules, right? The natural world does not follow the rules of ones and zeros. It follows these kind of quantum physics rules. So if we can build a computer that simulates those quantum physics rules, then we're going to be much better at simulating biology, chemistry, physics, you know, designing new medicines, finding materials for better batteries, you know, and things like that. And then it's also going to be good at certain very difficult, complicated mathematical problems, like finding the best route if you've got to make like 25 stops, finding the most optimal route between them, and other complicated mathematical problems that are really difficult for current classical computers.
Okay, so we've had this announcement today from Microsoft. There's so much competition in the tech world, isn't there, at the moment? How is this announcement being received? Is it welcomed?
Yeah, so I think there's probably some people are taking it with a little bit of a pinch of salt. So Microsoft have been trying to do this for almost 20 years, and they've really embarked on a very different approach to the other companies in the field that are doing this, you know, Google, Amazon, etc., IBM. And this was really like a kind of Hail Mary play. Like they were, when they started doing this, it was really like no one was really sure if it would actually work or not, if it was even a real thing. So some, you know, experts are skeptical as to whether the claims that Microsoft have made are actually going to come to fruition. But certainly they've made a big splash.
And in terms of where this technology could lead us, are people worried about any of the doors it may open? What might some of the setbacks be?
Yeah, so one of the things that a quantum computer in theory could do is run something called Shor's algorithm, which helps you factor prime numbers into their kind of constituent parts. And the reason that's important is that factoring prime numbers is a really key part of a lot of cryptography. So it's really difficult for computers to factor large prime numbers. And that is what protects a lot of our data through things like RSA encryption. So a lot of email data, a lot of end-to-end encryption messengers like, you know, WhatsApp use this mathematical problem to protect our data. So if a quantum computer can break that, that means essentially like a lot of data could be up for grabs. Mm-hmm. A lot of sensitive information could be out there in the open.
Amit Katwala, their features editor at Wired magazine, and his book Quantum Computing, How It Works and Why It Could Change the World is out now. In Syria, it's now 2 months since the fall of the Assad regime. Bashar al-Assad and his family were given asylum in Russia and are thought to be in Moscow. But for ordinary Syrians, the work of rebuilding homes, families and communities after years of civil war and decades of authoritarian rule continues. Human rights organisations estimate that over 100,000 Syrians have disappeared since the uprising began in 2011. More than 3,000 children are also among the missing. Well, the BBC has found evidence that some children who were detained with their families were transferred to orphanages. And while many of those have been reunited with their families, other children are yet to be found. Our correspondent Lina Sinjab sent this report from Damascus.
At Merge Square in central Damascus, men and women gather from across Syria. Each hold a photograph of one of the thousands of Syrians whose fate is still unknown after the fall of Bashar al-Assad.
This is my cousin, actually. We lost him when he was 16 years old. They came and they arrested him. His father shot. He was not doing anything.
Human rights organizations say hundreds of the missing are children. Atiya Al Musa and his wife Ghaziye are searching for traces of their missing granddaughters, 4-year-old Cham and 5-year-old Islam. They, along with their mother Hiba, were taken in 2014 by the security forces who raided their house in a suburb of Damascus.
We search in security branches. We were told they are in state security. Somebody told me that some girls were sent from detention centers to Lahn al-Hayat orphanage, but they denied having them.
After the fall of the regime, the search started. Reports came out that some children who went missing could be found at orphanages. Like many families, Atiya and his wife desperately hope they will find their loved ones.
No one is helping us, neither the Ministry of Social Affairs nor the orphanages. We lost our daughter. Are we going to lose her daughters too?
The Ministry of Social Affairs say they are investigating the cases of missing children. I met Mr. Ahmed Anizi, who is in charge of searching the dusty, messy and untouched files found in the basement of the ministry.
We are not getting results yet because those in charge of these orphanages are complicit with the previous regime.
Mass graves are regularly being discovered. In 1 week, 4 were discovered in this neighborhood in Damascus. The White Helmet Civil Defense say there were remains of children among the bodies.
In many places like this one, the bodies are burned to cover the evidence. Parents who are hoping to find their missing children, for them, the greatest fear is that they might be in the bones found here.
The basement's owner, Ahmed Laham Sayed, says for years he knew there were bodies below and couldn't talk. He told me he had nightmares hearing the cries of women and children.
This is Lahn al-Hayat orphanage, where Mr. Musa and his wife Ghaziya came to find traces of their granddaughters. We've been told that this is a place that received many children by order of security forces of the Assad regime without any proper documentation. Mr. Mu'tasim Thaloumi is the new director. I asked him whether he knows anything about the case of Sham and Islam.
No, I don't. But I learned that many families used to come here looking for their children. We welcome any family here. We want to help.
For Atiya and Ghaziye, this might not be comforting. But for some of the children here, there is now a better chance of being found.
The BBC's Lina Shinjab there with that report from Damascus in Syria. Welcome back to NewsHour. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has warned Israelis that tomorrow, Thursday, is going to be a heartbreaking day for the country. Hamas has said it will hand over 4 bodies of hostages who've died in captivity, including children. I've been hearing more from the BBC's Mark Lowen in Jerusalem.
Israel now says that it has received the list of the names of the bodies to be received tomorrow, Thursday. 4 dead hostages will be handed over, Rebecca, from Hamas to Israel, and they will be the first of the dead bodies, the dead hostages, officially handed over by Hamas since the ceasefire with Israel came into place. And so it is going to be an extremely painful day. Hamas says that among the dead are the Bibas family. This is Shiri Bibas, who was seized on the 7th of October with her husband Yarden and their 2 sons, Ariel, who was just 4 years old on that day and on the 7th of October 2023, and Kafir, who was just 9 months old. And they are the 2 youngest of the hostages, of the 251 hostages seized. And they are very much symbols of the brutality of that day. Their faces are shown all around the country in posters, in murals, 2 little boys with red hair, and they've very much become icons of that day. Mm. And we also understand that Oded Lifshitz, who is 84 years old, is one of those also whose bodies will be handed over. Mm. Now, after Thursday, then on Saturday, 6 living hostages will be handed over. That is double the number that was originally planned, and then a further 4 dead bodies next week, and that will bring to a close the number of hostages released in phase 1 of the ceasefire deal, 33 who will have been handed over, both dead and alive.
And Mark, in previous handovers, we've seen these long parades, haven't we, of Hamas fighters or gunmen at least parading hostages ahead of their release. And I noticed that the Red Cross is calling for privacy and dignity ahead of these expected releases of the bodies.
Yeah, I mean, I think the hope, really, clearly the hope in Israel is that this will not be a publicised affair in the glare of the media spotlight. And yes, there's pressure from the ICRC, the Red Cross, which is usually the intermediary that receives the hostages from Hamas or from Islamic Jihad, the other group that's holding them. There's pressure from them, there's pressure from the Israeli government via mediators for it not to be televised. It's also scheduled to be pretty bad weather tomorrow, actually, so that could stop kind of public gatherings in Gaza for the handover. But it is going to be, yes, it's going to be a very painful day.
That's the BBC's Mark Lowen following that story for us in Jerusalem. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC. I'm Rebecca Kesby. Let's return to our main story now, the strong criticism of the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky by US President Donald Trump, who described the Ukrainian leader today in a social media post as a dictator without elections. Well, earlier I spoke to Kira Rudik. She's a Ukrainian MP and leader of the opposition Holos Party, which has 20 seats in Parliament. I asked her, would she welcome a chance to challenge her political rival Volodymyr Zelensky in fresh elections, and should martial law be lifted to enable the vote?
The martial law will be lifted when Ukraine would feel that it is safe for us to let our army go home. It's against Ukrainian constitution to conduct them during the martial law. And then if we're talking practically, then there is a question on security of people. And you know, Rebecca, sometimes we have air raid sirens on for a good half of the day, sometimes the whole day. So what if that happens during the course of the election? Second point is we have about millions of people involved in defending our country. So these people not only deserve to be able to participate in the elections to exercise on their right to vote, but also to their right to be elected. And right now, it is impossible to achieve. Third thing is we have 6 to 8 million people right now residing abroad after this full-scale invasion started. And we see no good way of giving them an assurance that they will be able to participate in the democracy.
Okay, so you're putting national unity ahead at the moment, but earlier today, President Zelensky accused President Trump of living in a disinformation space created by Russia, basically accusing the US president of being led by Moscow. Was that, in your view, a wise diplomatic move by a Ukrainian president that's dependent on US aid at the moment?
Rebecca, I think the recent statements that we heard from President Trump, and as a human being, I don't know how to explain them to Ukrainian people rather than saying that this is a negotiating technique. And I can only assume that President Zelensky said what he said because it's not the new information and these are not new statements that we have heard from President Trump. And previously, we have heard them exactly from Russian propaganda.
So if your party was in power in Ukraine at the moment, would you accept some of the terms for peace that are being discussed by the Americans at the moment, such as giving up Ukrainian land potentially, doing a deal on mineral wealth, accepting that there's no path towards Ukraine having a place in NATO? Would you accept that?
Rebecca, I do not see the baseline for even discussing these terms, because we hear what Ukraine needs to give up, but we do not hear what are the security guarantees that we are getting. Ukraine has been in this war with Russia since 2014. And since 2014, when Russia first annexed Crimea and took over some of the eastern regions, we have been in so-called ceasefire, quote-unquote, deal, where I can tell you that there was not a single day when Russia would honor this deal. So our question is the following: who or what will make sure that this time will be different? And because we already have an experience of Budapest memorandum, when Ukraine has given up on our nuclear arsenal for their promises of the protection and of our sovereignty and territorial integrity by the United Kingdom, United States, and Russia, right now there are many questions that are not being answered. And so any talks about what Ukraine needs to give up may be considered only after we know how do we make sure that Russia would not attack us again.
So basically, your position would be exactly the same as Mr. Zelensky's is today if you were in power.
Absolutely. You know why? Because President Zelensky, I believe right now, is having the best national interest in mind. And in this matter, though I can criticize him internally as much as I want, in this matter, we truly support him and we are standing united because we know that it's a matter of our physical survival and survival as a nation.
What went through your mind when you heard President Trump saying last night, well, seeming to say that he thought Ukraine had started the war?
Rebecca, I wish no politician or no human being would be in the position to have to explain something like this to people who are fighting at the front line currently, or to people who have lost the most in this war, to people whose children have been kidnapped by Russia, to people who have seen their homes destroyed or their families killed.
Ukrainian opposition leader Kira Rudik there. Now, the Netherlands has announced that it will return more than 100 Benin bronzes to Nigeria. Thousands of these culturally significant sculptures and carvings were stolen during the violent destruction of Benin City in modern-day Nigeria's Edo State. This is back in the 1890s. The treasures were sold, some to private collectors and others to museums. And I've been speaking to Barnaby Phillips. He's author of Loot, Britain and the Benin Bronzes, and he told me more about the history.
Benin was a powerful kingdom in, as you say, what is today southern Nigeria that prospered for many hundreds of years. It was beginning to decline by the late 19th century, and British commercial interests were getting, I suppose you might say, more aggressive, more imperialistic, if you like. And in early 1897, a British expedition, unarmed, in fact, was on its way to Benin City to try and make the king, the Oba, respect the terms of an earlier treaty, which you would probably say the Oba had been coerced into signing by the British. That expedition was attacked and several members of it were killed. In retaliation, the British sent a much larger expedition, a punitive expedition, so-called, which defeated the Benin Kingdom, incorporated its territories into its new protectorate, and then almost by the way, as it were, looted thousands of these extraordinary objects, which were brought back to London in the spring of 1897. The largest collection ended up in the British Museum, but many of them were auctioned off, often by individual officers who had taken part in the looting. And in that way, they were dispersed across Germany, France to a certain extent, but yes, the Netherlands. That is how they spread across Western Europe.
And so the Netherlands are going to send theirs back to Nigeria. But this is an ongoing debate all over the place, not least here in the UK, isn't it, in terms of whether such artefacts should be sent back to where they come from. What are the arguments for and against that?
Well, the arguments are complex on both sides, but I think it's fair to say that the Benin bronzes have become emblematic, I suppose, of colonial loot because the way in which they were taken was so shocking and so well documented, and because they are really amongst the greatest artworks, if you can call them artworks. That's what they became under a Western eye. I think many Edo people would call them spiritual religious pieces before that. But I suppose it's it's that question, to whom does culture belong? The British Museum, which has, as I say, the largest collection, they would argue that this is part of a global patrimony. And here in London, for example, some 6 million people a year go to the British Museum and they can see the Benin bronzes and they can compare them, say, with the Parthenon marbles or the treasures of Greece or ancient Egypt, and see what human progress is. So of course, the Edo people, and indeed Nigerians, would say our culture has been stolen and we want it back.
Writer Barnaby Phillips. Now, could a new treatment developed in Ukraine help with severe pain management and reduce reliance on strong painkillers like opioids, which can be addictive and have other unpleasant side effects? New research trialled among amputee patients in Ukraine called hydrodissection could be a game changer, according to Dr. Stephen Cohen, who led the research. He's professor of pain medicine at Northwestern University. So first, what is hydrodissection?
When they amputate a limb, they also cut nerves. And when you injure nerves, the chance of someone having pain that doesn't go away is much higher than when tissue is injured. And so hydrodissection involves using ultrasound to inject very high volumes of fluid. It could be local anesthetic, it could involve steroid, saline, in this case, a sugar solution. And it breaks up scar tissue. It can improve blood flow to the scarred nerves that are not receiving blood flow. It could wash out, if it's done early on, calcifications that can form and be painful. It can stop these nerve endings from spontaneously firing. And it can release them when they're scarred down.
The best thing would be to use this process early on in an injury, but could you also use it on an old injury?
We know that outcomes are better for acute pain than for chronic pain. So some of the potential advantages for doing this early is, like, when calcifications form, they're probably extremely difficult to wash out if it's late. And the studies are mixed, like when they use, you know, high volume washouts with fluid, whether it can prevent calcifications. But the other thing that happens with chronic pain is that your nervous system becomes more sensitized. And that becomes really, really difficult to treat.
We do know that a lot of people do rely on strong painkillers, don't they, including opioids, to control that kind of pain. What are some of the problems associated with that?
Severe pain after trauma or an operation and opioid use, and they go together, strongly predict chronic pain, so pain that doesn't go away. Now, a big thing in the United States at some of the top hospitals are trying to get people off opioids before elective procedures. It's been shown to improve outcomes and decrease hospital stays and costs. You know, in a very young population that's been exposed to physical and psychological trauma, there is an extremely high rate of psychiatric problems, and younger people are more prone to problems with opioids, not only abuse, but they develop tolerance at much more rapid rates, and they develop something called hyperalgesia, where paradoxically, opioids make people more sensitive to pain.
I mean, I know you've been doing this research in Ukraine where so many people have lost limbs and there's an urgent need for this kind of treatment there. But could it work with other pain management for things other than amputations, like simple back pain, things like that?
They've studied it for chronic pain from tissue injury, and they've studied it for neuropathic pain or pain that follows injuries to nerves. And you know, the results are very auspicious, but I will say the studies are not super large and super high quality.
But potentially, the potential's there.
The potential is definitely there.
Dr. Stephen Cohen there, Professor of Pain Medication at Northwestern University, speaking to us earlier. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. Now, when South Korea's president declared martial law in early December, he justified his power grab by claiming that pro-North Korea communist forces had infiltrated the parliament and were trying to overthrow the country. He didn't provide any actual evidence for that, but 2 months on from this failed coup, his supporters have been whipped into an anti-communist frenzy and conspiracy theories have taken hold. Support for the impeached and imprisoned president appears to be growing. Thousands are taking to the streets each week to demand his release as the country's political crisis deepens. Our Seoul correspondent Jean McKenzie has been following the protests.
I'm near South Korea's Constitutional Court, where at the moment the impeached and imprisoned president is testifying, and his supporters have rallied outside. They want him released, they want him returned to office, and they are shouting some pretty extreme things. They're saying that the left-leaning opposition party are communists and that the leader of the opposition should be executed. Why are you here today?
This moment is the conflict between the people who pursue communists and the people who pursue democracy.
When the president here declared martial law, when he tried to disable the parliament, have the army take over, he justified this extreme move by claiming that the parliament had been infiltrated by people who were pro-North Korea, pro-communist. Now, he didn't provide any evidence, but since then, these ideas have really taken hold.
My name is Jungmin and I'm 22 years old.
Why are you worried about North Korea?
If the next president would be the leader of Democratic Party, what he's talking about is to become one with Kim Jong-un.
There's no denying these threats used to be very real. I've climbed to the top of one of my favourite mountains in Seoul. There's a tree here which is covered in bullet marks. These are from a battle here in 1968 when a group of North Korean commandos crawled across the border and tried to assassinate the president. During this time, spies would regularly try to infiltrate the government. And it was common for South Korea's military dictators to accuse their political opponents of conspiring with Pyongyang. Experts say Mr. Yoon has exploited these historic fears.
Before Yoon Song-yeol, we did have extreme groups saying extreme things.
Sang-shin Lee is a polling expert for the Korea Institute for National Unification.
But they were isolated. But now Yoon Song-yeol gave those extreme words presidential authority. President, of course, have the most information about our society. When he says that the left-wing liberal political parties are North Korean sympathizers, people believe that.
It's a Saturday afternoon, and the main road through the centre of Seoul has been closed off to traffic because thousands of people have come out to support Mr. Yoon. They're waving Korean flags, holding placards, there are speakers up on a stage. These aren't just Mr. Yoon's core supporters, older, ultra-conservatives, people who've lived through the Cold War and have long been afraid of North Korea and communism. There are young people here today. There are people who, before this martial law crisis, didn't even support the president.
Like most young people, I thought, how can martial law be declared in the 21st century? I was very critical. But after researching it on YouTube, I realized I was wrong. It was unavoidable. If I had been in the president's position, I'd have done it too.
Something people keep telling me is that they don't trust mainstream media. Even the conservative press here has been very critical of Mr. Yoon. And so these people have turned to YouTube, where there are these very popular right-wing channels that are amplifying these sort of messages. One idea the president has dangled that has really taken hold is that China interfered in South Korea's election last year and rigged the result. I noticed that you're holding a sign which says CCP out, so Chinese Communist Party out. Why is that?
I believe China is interfering in all our political affairs. It is pulling the strings behind the scenes. I didn't fully understand the extent of it until recently.
Truth,
The protest turned violent last month when a group of young men smashed up a courthouse looking to take revenge against a judge who'd helped detain the president. These were shocking scenes for a country which prides itself on its tradition of peaceful protest. Kim Jong-sik, a young Conservative Party supporter, was there.
I heard people saying, now our country is in the hands of China and South Korea will become like Hong Kong. Not a single politician has been critical of China, but President Yoon was brave enough to speak out.
These views could create problems for the country's opposition Democratic Party. I've come to the parliament to meet one of their most seasoned politicians.
I am Wee Song Lak. I'm a lawmaker from the Democratic Party.
What do you say to these claims that it is the Democratic Party that is secretly colluding with North Korea, secretly colluding with China?
They are simply not true, cooked up concept to demonize the opposition and to justify martial law. Probably these ideas may spread a little bit further. Majority of people understand what's going on, and majority of people are yearning for the return to normalcy.
The court is expected to rule in the next month on whether to bar Mr. Yoon from office. Then there would be elections, and South Korea will have the chance to move on. But just like the bullet holes on this mountain, people's memories and fears of the past will always be here. Politicians now are going to have to work really hard to put this country back together.
The BBC's Jean McKenzie reporting there from Seoul. Well, just before we go, we've had some news in from Downing Street here in London. This is on our top story. We've had a statement from the British Prime Minister Keir Starmer's office saying that Mr. Starmer has spoken to Volodymyr Zelensky, President Zelensky of Ukraine this evening. He expressed his support for Mr. Zelensky as Ukraine's democratically elected leader, and he said that it was perfectly reasonable to suspend elections during wartime, as the UK did during World War II. But he added that he reiterated his support, though, for the US-led efforts to get a lasting peace in Ukraine that deterred Russia from any future aggression. So a bit of diplomacy to add into the mix there from the UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer's office this evening. That's it for this edition. Thanks so much for joining us.